This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Between Tokyo and San Francisco lies more than 5,000 miles of open ocean. And long-distance swimmer Ben LeCompte plans to swim every one of those miles in just 180 days. The goal is to raise awareness about issues of sustainability and ocean health. But along the way, he'll also be contributing to a variety of research projects, tracking everything from changes in his heart to the microbes in his gut, plastic pollution, and the fate of radioactivity from the Fukushima nuclear disaster. Ben LeCompte, welcome to Living Lab.
Thank you for having me.
We invite you to join our conversation. Our toll-free phone number is 866-999-4626. You can also send email to livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. Ben, why swim across the Pacific Ocean?
Well, it starts with a passion. My father taught me how to swim in the Atlantic Ocean when I was five, and I have been swimming in the water and in open water since then. And through all those years, I have noticed a lot of changes. I have noticed less fish, plastic floating, plastic on the beach. Each time you walk on the beach, you see plastic. And now I am a father. So for me, it's very important to use what I am passionate about to get attention and to try to make a little difference in the life that I'm going to pass on to my children. Because we all know that the way we live right now, we cannot sustain that life. And do we want to be a generation that is going to say, well, I just passed that liability to the next generation? Or do we want to try to do something? And for me, it's what I am intended to do, to use my passion, what is very close to me, love for the ocean, for the open water, to get people's attention and hopefully engage them into changing some of our behavior, because that's where the problem is.
A lot of us, there are plenty of us who have grown up swimming in the ocean and are aware of these issues, but it would never occur to most of us that it would even be possible to swim across an ocean, let alone to think that we might be the person who could do it. What gave you the idea that you could swim all the way across an ocean?
Because when I look at it, and when I was training for the Atlantic, I never looked at the whole. I looked at every day or every hours. When you start training and you start on planning a swim, you just look and work on section. So I know I can swim 8 hours a day. I know I can sustain it for a few days, on and on and on. And after, it's just mind over matter. Because swimming, it's not a hard on your body. It's not like running, where you have hard impact on your joint. It's very easy on the body. You see a lot of old people swimming, old swimmers. So what makes it difficult is the environment, being in an hostile environment and being limited in terms of stimuli that you get, not a lot of communication with the outside. And so it's much more mind over matter, and you have to be focused, and you have to train your mind to be able to be in that that type of situation.
You mentioned that you've already swum across the Atlantic Ocean. What were some of the biggest challenges during that time?
Well, I cannot put my finger just on one. It's the accumulation. You know, someday you feel bad, you have had a bad night, so you are very tired. Another day you have trouble eating, so you are being sick in the water swimming, and then you throw up, basically. Someday the wetsuit is going to rub a little more than other days, so it starts to be painful. So if you have that accumulated in one day with a lack of sleep, stomach, you know, problem and all that, makes it very difficult for that particular day. But if you try to isolate and deal with each issues and find a solution, then you can go through.
You dealt with, on your swim across the Atlantic, both sharks and jellyfish. Those apparently don't make your top list of the challenges. How do you plan to deal with those going across the Pacific? Do you have a different plan in place?
The plan would be the same, because you cannot exactly control what is coming. And I make two different boxes. One box of things that I can control and another box of things that I cannot control. And whatever I cannot control, I'm not going to worry about. I know that we take precautions. I know that we have devices to repel a shark. But for example, when the jellyfish are there, There is nothing I can do. They are there to stay. So
what happened? But you still swim.
I still swim. And what happened? But you have to understand that I wear a wetsuit, a snorkel, and goggles that cover most of my face. So the exposed area are limited, my hands and my face. And if it's a big jellyfish that is floating on the water, then I can't see it. I just avoid it. The problem is that when they are in schools and very tight together that I have to swim through, it happened for one day in the Atlantic that I had to swim through. So I was stung continuously on the face. And that was probably the most painful day I had swimming.
I can imagine.
But, you know, you cannot control it. So you have to do on each day, you have to find the best way to deal with that problem.
And you mentioned a device to repel sharks. What's that?
It's a device that creates a magnetic field in the water. And sharks are sensitive to a magnetic field. And we saw it because the first encounter with the shark, we saw a fin swimming around the boat in the morning. But as soon as we put the device in the water, then the fin disappeared. In the evening, when we turned that device off, the fin reappeared again. So it was a little hide-and-seek game like that for 5 days.
That sounds like a kind of harrowing mental thing, if there's a shark that might be just out of sight, just below somewhere, because clearly it didn't go very far away if all you had to do was turn off the device and it was back.
Yes, exactly. It was in the back of my mind, but you try to to rely on what you know, the device, the people there to look out for you and to do what you are there to do.
Now, we should make clear that when you're talking about swimming across an ocean, this is not like swimming the English Channel or swimming from Cuba to Florida. You are not doing this 24 hours a day straight through. What is the setup and how do you actually sustain this for months at a time?
Yeah, absolutely. That is very important to understand that I sleep on the boat, I eat on the boat, I do everything else on the boat. I stay about 8 hours a day in the water. And then with a GPS system, when I get out of the water, we log the location. And the boat brings me back to that location the following day. So, I don't spend the whole time in the water, of course.
Now, do you get a boost from the boat? Are you swimming close enough to the boat that you could be kind of dragging on the boat the way swimmers do on a swimmer in the next lane in the Olympics or something like that?
I stay beside the boat. The boat is dragging a line that goes under the water parallel to the boat. That will be the same type of idea. When you have a line at the bottom of the pool, you don't have to lift up your head to know where you are going. So it's the same idea. The boat is dragging a line. The shark device is attached to that line. And you have different marking on that line. So it tells me if I am falling behind the boat or being a little ahead. I try to be very close and in the middle of the boat.
And are they driving at a speed, a pre-agreed upon speed that is the speed you like to swim?
Well, they try to follow my speed, and they give me the direction to follow. And I use a snorkel, so I don't have to lift up my head. I just stay on that line as close as possible to the line.
In case you're just joining us, I'm talking with Ben LeCompte. He's taking off soon on an adventure he calls The Longest Swim, an attempt to swim across the Pacific Ocean. Our toll-free phone number is 866-999-4626. You can also send email to livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. Ben, how many calories do you burn when you swim for 8 hours a day, and how do you eat enough food to keep up with that?
Yeah, that's a big challenge because I use about 8,000 calories per day.
8,000?
Yes. So when I am in the water, I cannot eat much. It's just liquid every 20 minutes to 30 minutes that I get.
Is that something they're handing to you from the boat?
Exactly. Exactly. I stay in the water the whole time, so they just throw it to me and I throw it back to them. And 8,000 calories, you cannot eat that in two meals. So when I get out of the water, the first thing that I do is eat. And then I will eat the morning also when I wake up. But what happened at night, I wake up just because I'm hungry.
You're like a newborn. You have to eat every 2 hours all night.
It's exactly that. Exactly that.
What do you eat? I mean, what has enough calories? Are you? I presume you're not eating Big Macs four times a day, but how do you actually get enough calories out of your food?
You know, once you stop swimming, you are not picky. Anything you can find that you can eat, you just eat it. I don't eat any sugar. I try to stay away from sugar. So my diet base is a lot of fat and a complex carb, but I stay away from sugar.
Is that only when you're swimming, or is that something that you do all of the time?
No, I do all the time now to prepare my body to it, because it's much more efficient to use fat as a source of energy than carbs. So that's what I do.
And what else does your training regime look like? How many months or years do you spend really intensively focused on training this for this? And I mean, is it just swimming 8 hours a day as many days as you can, or are there other things that you're doing to train?
No, the way I train, I do 3 to 5 hours of training. So it can be a combination of running, bicycling, and swimming. I try not to swim as much so that I still have the pleasure of going in the water and swimming.
How do you keep your mind occupied for 8 hours in the water?
Yeah, that's the key. Because when you think about swimming, you are faced with the same blue background, you are faced with the same stimuli, the water rushing through your hands, your face, you hear the same water through your ears. So it doesn't change, it's always the same. What you have to do is to have a schedule of what you are going to occupy your mind with. So before going in the water, have a schedule, like going to school. You will have first hour an English class, and then after a math class, and so on. So for me, I have a predetermined schedule where the first hour I'm going to, for example, relive an event that I have lived in the past, like a birthday, or going to a wedding, or a very important moment. I'm
so
going to relive that.
Memories, reliving memories, and kind of a visualization exercise.
Exactly. And then the next hour I will be designing a house, for example. And so I occupy my day.
How like many that. Houses have you designed?
It's one that I, you know, tweak all the time. Yeah, I have a big town by now.
You could have your home at home actually perfected in your mind, everything fixed.
Yes. And also one of the other exercises is to visualize what it will be to go in a city that I have never been to. So when I was swimming across the Atlantic, I had never been to New York. So I was thinking about New York, how it will be. And what is important to do is to engage your senses as much as possible. So when you try to visualize a scene, you have to feel the sun on your skin. You have to smell the perfume of people just crossing by you. You have to be very aware of what sound you are going to have. Is it a car driving by? And does it make a right? So as much you can involve your senses into that exercise, then it becomes very easy to dissociate your mind from your body. Because throughout the day, it's what I'm trying to do with those different hours of exercises that I do with my mind, is to dissociate my mind from my body. And as soon as you do that, then your body is in autopilot. You swim and you don't think about it, and your mind is somewhere else.
Is the stopping for food every 20 minutes, as you said, to take a little bit of liquid food, does that seem like an interruption, a disruption when you're in this very meditative mental space?
No, sometimes you don't realize it. It becomes, you know, it becomes second nature. And I have been in situations that I know I was taking my car and I needed to go somewhere. I didn't realize that I was driving up until the time I got to my destination. And I know I had traffic light and all that because I was already meditating in that state.
That's a little scary.
Yeah, but apparently it was okay. Yeah, I made it.
Do you actually find the swimming, your time in the water, is it enjoyable for you?
Oh, it has to be. First, that's the first thing. It has to be. Yes, very much so. It is it's hard to describe, and people ask me, but why do you want to do that? What exactly pushes you? It's hard for me to put words into what I feel and how I feel, but it's very fulfilling. It's hard to put words. Yeah.
You're going to be gone for 6 months for this swim. You have 2 fairly young children. How does your family feel about it when you take off on these long swims? You're gone from home. It's potentially dangerous. How do they feel about that?
Well, first, let's talk about the danger. I used to ride a motorcycle in Paris. I used to ride a motorcycle in Dallas and other cities. There is much more danger riding a motorcycle in those cities than to swim in the middle of the ocean. People are thinking that the ocean is very dangerous, but if you take a lot of precaution, it's less dangerous than what we are doing here on a daily basis. And so for my children, they know exactly what I am doing, what I am passionate about. And my daughter, who is 14, she totally understands it, and she's very engaged in it and interested in what I am doing. My son is 8, so he's a little young to understand, but he loves the ocean. He loves the fish. He loves the life. And so he's very interested in that aspect and asks me questions. So are you going to see sharks, and what shark? You know, I see a documentary on whale sharks, and look at that, Daddy. So he's involved in it at another level.
Will you be communicating with them while you're out swimming?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yes.
That's long-distance swimmer Ben LeCompte. Later this summer, he'll attempt to swim from Tokyo to San Francisco in just 180 days. We'll talk more about the research he'll be contributing to along the way when Living Lab continues after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with long-distance open ocean swimmer Ben LeCompte about his upcoming attempt to swim across the Pacific Ocean. Along the way, he'll be contributing to a variety of research on both human and ocean health. One of his science partners is Ken Bissler, a marine chemist at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, who's been studying the fate of radioactivity released into the ocean by the Fukushima nuclear disaster. Ben and Ken are in the studio with me now, and we hope you'll join our conversation. Our toll-free phone number is 866-999-4626. You can also send email to livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. Ben, your swim is slated to start in August, right?
September
now, mm-hmm. From Tokyo. I mean, you're taking off from Japan. You're raising awareness about ocean issues. Did you immediately think that you wanted to have some component of this touching on the Fukushima nuclear disaster and its impact on the oceans?
Not particular on that aspect, but science was a big part of it, because I look at it as the swim being just a way to get people's attention and after to be a platform for science and get the facts right about what we are doing to the ocean. And you need scientists to be there to be able to get the right data. And that's why Dr. Bessler is a perfect person to be a part of this research and the platform.
Ken, when you first were introduced to this idea, what was your reaction? The idea of trying to do some sort of science alongside this amazing attempt to swim over 5,000 miles across the Pacific?
Well, I have to say, and I'm pleased to be here, that you know, it was a bit of shock and disbelief that someone could even attempt this or try to attempt this. I've been going out on research boats for 30 years. I know what it takes to get a sample to do analyses for these radionuclides. So it wasn't a trivial effort, but once I heard about it, I just realized how great it would be to engage the public, get people following this swim at the same time that we're collecting scientific data, in this case on the radionuclides. And the track is just perfect for what I've been focused on, our concerns with the releases from Fukushima on the coast of Japan. His track following the Kuroshio Current is basically the same track that those radioactive contaminants take as they go across the Pacific and reaching our coastline now 4.5 years later.
You've also been helping Ben kind of hook up with other scientists around Woods Hole and more broadly in the scientific community. Give us a sense of some of those other connections and what some of the other research that might get incorporated into this swim looks like.
Well, on the ocean side, as we'll hear later, you know, studies of plastics, things that you'll find along the way, other contaminants. We've been looking into finding a partner for some of the pH measurements, ocean acidity. You know, I figured as long as we're there, we should try and get as many measurements as we can to put this in context. And then as there's also studies just of Ben's changes, his physiology, his heart, his gut. So there's research groups looking at both sides of it. So what's in the water and what's happening to Ben as he swims is all part of this effort now.
Ben, the monitoring of your heart and the changes that might take place over the course of this fairly extreme exercise is really interesting. How is your heart going to be monitored over this 6-month swim?
It's going to be monitored by a doctor who monitors heart of astronauts. So it's going to use the same equipment. It's the remote guidance echo from NASA that will allow him to look at my heart remotely. I will just use a little probe and then point it in the right direction, and it will give me some direction as far as where I need to rotate the probe and so on. But it will have the exact same image that you will get when you go to a doctor's office.
How long does that take you to do? Are you doing that every day?
No, it's going to be once a month, and the session is about an hour.
Now, what about monitoring radioactivity? Ken, give us a sense. You said you know what it takes to get these samples. What will it take to get water samples and actually be monitoring radioactivity along the track of this swim?
Well, there's two main ways we'll be looking at, and looking for isotopes of cesium, one of the more abundant contaminants from Fukushima. We do the standard. We call it the standard sampling. 5 gallons of water is kind of what we use both in our research and when we're doing the citizen scientist sampling and crowdfunding along the West Coast through our radioactive ocean. And that allows us to measure what's already in the ocean to address the more important question, how much more was added. So it's a pretty large amount of water that we're going to teach Ben later today how to process so we can actually get through those samples and just bring back a smaller subsample, something that's been extracted from that 5-gallon sample. What's kind of more exciting, though, I've got sitting in front of me something we call the rad band, where we take some of those same chemical compounds we use in the lab, or in his case on the boat, attach them to a wearable device. It will be on Ben's leg for 8 hours, and that'll passively absorb the cesium through the waters as he swims. And so if we can get samples to compare to what's kind of the ground truth, what we know works, to this exciting new idea of wearing a device to sample your environment, in this case for radionuclides, I think that's going to be a huge breakthrough. And we can probably expand this to other elements, other compounds. But to show in real life situation of how well you could do this with just something on your leg. I mean, think of surfers up and down the coastline wearing these types of things. It would be wonderful to see that happen.
You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guests are open water swimmer Ben LeCompte and ocean chemist Ken Bissler. Our toll-free phone number is 866-999-4626. You can also send email to livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. Ben, if I were you and swimming for 8 hours a day, which I can't even imagine, but if I were to do that, I would definitely want to be wearing something on my ankle instead of the prospect of coming out of the water and now I've got a bunch of lab work to do to collect water and analyze water. I mean, do you look forward to having other things to do during the hours that you're on the boat, or are you pretty much crawling out of the water and straight into your bed?
Well, you have to understand that in order for me to do that, I need to have a team around me, a team to support me, a team to give me the right direction. They have a lot of different tasks that they are going to do, and most of them will be collect the data and the sample and filter the water and do that. Because, no, that's true. After 8 hours of swimming, the first thing you want to do, eat. The second thing you want to do is sleep.
Filtering water is nowhere on that list.
Yes, and that will occupy them because they are going to have a lot of dead time, and that would be perfect.
How close will you be going to Fukushima on your swim?
Well, as far as leaving from Fukushima, we try to get some answer from the government over there in Japan, but apparently they wouldn't like that for us to leave close from there. But we'll be in the water that are going to converge after into the Kuoshio.
So, does that concern you at all?
Not at all. I talked to Ken, and he told me there is no risk there, so I know he's the person to ask.
Ken, you mentioned that the swim will follow the same track as the radioactivity following the same current. What do you expect to see? Do you have any idea what you might see with this data?
We have some understanding because we've mostly measured, though, in Japan or, say, along the west coast of North America. So making that connection will be important. But the concentrations today are, I'd say, millions of times less than they were at the peak in 2011. There was a grave concern about those levels because it would have direct harm to marine life. Fortunately, they decreased, and as water mixes, the levels go down. Yet, even today, I'm going back in October in a research vessel because there is still an ongoing leak from that site. So levels might be 100 or 1,000 times higher. We're still talking about numbers that you could swim in them and I've insured Ben of this, but you could swim in them all day long for an entire year and get doses that are hundreds of times less than a single dental x-ray, thousands of times less on our coastline. So there are people swimming off of Japan at these levels. I'm still concerned about uptake into seafood products and, say, consuming things that might give you an internal dose, but much, much less about swimming.
And potentially a more concentrated dose, right? I mean, you're eating fish that have already been swimming in it for some period of time.
Right. And that's been improving constantly, too. But we still are more cautious always about what still could be coming out of there, because it will take decades for a complete cleanup. It's a very difficult situation to stop that groundwater essentially from coming into the ocean that has picked up some of these radioactive contaminants.
How are you going to pay for this research? It's not inexpensive to do the kinds of analyses that you have to do to figure out what the radioactivity levels are.
Well, I think we're going to use the Our Radioactive Ocean crowdfunding kind of model. It won't involve the citizens collecting their own samples, but we'll be asking for people to sponsor a given day, these 100 points across the Pacific, so they can adopt a sample, essentially. We can put up their name, their face, if they want. We also want to collect and find maybe larger corporate sponsors, foundations, the wealthy surfers out there who can really help move this rad band from a prototype into a production device where, you know, people might wear these, send them back to our lab for analyses, and have the app on the phone that's for the surfers. You know, surfers up, cesium is down. That's what I like to tell people. That's what we like to have, you know, this building of knowledge base of what, even when it's low, that's an important number to have. So we want this to be as widely and easily done as possible.
How will this data, 100 points, fit in with all of the other information that you've been collecting from research cruises? Is this a real scientific opportunity, or is this more about public outreach and awareness?
It's both, but actually there's a lot of science here that is going to work out very well, because we've been trying to track flow of contaminants. There's several models out there. They all give slightly different predictions. So the more times we can cross that line and cross the ocean, basically, and getting, in this case, more points than we've ever had, we can refine those models, those estimates, the physical transport of something that's dissolved in the ocean. And so that helps us not just from Fukushima, but God forbid this happens somewhere else or next time. We want to do much better in those predictions. So getting data is the one way to do that. And I think I like saying there's a quote from a guy, George Box, about all models are wrong, some are useful. We have some very useful models out there, but they're all approximations to what's really happening. So the more numbers we can get, more analyses, the better. And we need the public, though, to help pay for that.
And this rad band, it's, as you said, a wearable device. You've got one sitting here on the table in front of you, an anklet with kind of, I mean, it looks almost like a watch without the actual watch face. It's about that size. But that's the first one you've ever made. This has been kind of a prompt for you to get this idea that you've had simmering in the back of your mind for several months actually off the ground.
Yeah, we've had the idea for over a year now. It's just we haven't had the time or motivation to bring it further. And without funding, these things kind of sit on your shelf as a cool idea. But once we heard about the swim, we figured this is a perfect opportunity to make something that really will work. I'm confident we can get some data from this. How well it will work, we'll see. So we don't know if it's the best design in terms of its efficiency, how well it extracts the cesium. In theory, it could work much better, in fact, than just this 5-gallon sample. We can get more water through this little device than we can with our samples.
So this swim is actually a great opportunity to test those two different kinds of analyses side by side. He can wear it and then hop out of the water and do the traditional analysis.
Yeah, what better platform than, you know, an 8-hour swim on someone's ankle like Ben? It's going to be moving all the way, all the time, in contact with new water as he moves along. This is just probably ideal conditions.
How much do those rad bands cost?
Well, you know, the plastic components, we're talking to the engineer who you would design this, and, you know, you could probably build these for $2.50 for the plastic part. There's about $5 worth of resin material, but it still takes us $200 to $300 to do one analysis. So we can't ever reduce the cost, any way I can think of measuring cesium at these very low levels. If they were harmful or higher, then it would be much easier. You could analyze these for quite quickly. But we're talking kind of research analytical equipment in the basement of a building that costs $100,000 a piece, a gamma detector. And on that detector, I can analyze 100 to 150 samples per year. So we also are going to need to find some funding when all these samples come back to buy additional detectors to increase our capacity. So it is kind of like a business model that doesn't quite work, in that the more samples we get, the more money I have to find to do the analyses. Up to now, I can use equipment that over my career we've been able to purchase through federal grants. National Science Foundation, for example, has funded a lot of the equipment in my lab. But they don't want to fund this type of research. The idea of monitoring radioactivity falls outside of agencies like NOAA that don't look at radioactive compounds in the ocean, Department of Energy that does all kinds of wonderful work on radioactivity, but it's only on land, not when it gets in the ocean or gets salty. And so we're kind of falling between the cracks in terms of the federal funding, who's responsible scale. And that's why we have to keep going back to the public to help support us.
You've done a bunch of different funding models to cover your Fukushima research, from foundations, private foundations who helped you get out there very early on after the disaster, as you said, crowdfunding, the Our Radioactive Ocean Project, now this. Do you think that your response to Ben and this idea would have been different several years ago, before all of that crowdfunding and public outreach experience that you've already had through trying to fund your Fukushima research?
That's a good question. And yeah, I think it wouldn't have been the same. Now that I've actually seen the potential, not really, it's not as much about the funding as just engaging the public and letting them know more about this radioactive world. The question should be, how much more cesium do we add? Because there's cesium already there. There are levels that we experience of many radionuclides, natural and man-made, and getting that story out, I think, helps people put these things in context. Yes, be very, very worried in 2011 near Japan, be in that water. No, don't be scared about swimming in the Pacific right now along the West Coast. So knowing something about the concentrations helps me provide that message to a public that really has very little understanding of radioactivity, because it's this seemingly, and it is a very scary thing, can be harmful. But if you know something about how much is there relative to other sources, you can put it in perspective of other risks that we have in our lives.
It sounds like your experience of crowdfunding and crowdsourcing has changed your whole perspective on your science and your relationship, your personal relationship with the public as a scientist.
Yeah, I spend much more time now trying to translate some of these simple lessons to whether it's video products, lectures. I'm going out in a month to give more lectures on the West Coast where there's still a concern. Finding ways to translate this kind of very specialized science that very few people do into something that people ask, is it safe? Is it safe to eat the fish? Is it okay to go swimming? And so just providing that a link between the science and those very basic questions, I find quite satisfying. And at least through the crowdfunding model, I'm able to support that type of activity.
That's ocean chemist Ken Bissler of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Thank you, Ken.
Welcome.
I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with open ocean swimmer Ben LeCompte. Up next, the plastics research Ben will be doing while he swims across the Pacific later this year. If you have questions or comments, our toll-free phone number is 866-999-4626. You can also send email to livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. Living Lab continues after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone, and with me is long-distance swimmer Ben LeCompte, who will soon attempt to swim across the Pacific Ocean from Tokyo to San Francisco. Along the way, he'll be helping a variety of scientists, including some plastics researchers based here in Woods Hole. Linda Amaral-Zettler of the Marine Biological Laboratory is one of them, and she joins us now. Linda, welcome.
Thank you, Heather.
We also welcome your questions and comments. Our toll-free phone number is 866-999-4626. Our email address is livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. Ben, your swim seems to have some dubious honors in terms of where you get to actually swim. So you're starting close to Fukushima, and then out in the middle of the Pacific, you're going to get to swim through this area that's known as the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. There's some misperceptions about what that actually is, the idea that this is a floating island of trash in the middle of the Pacific. What is your expectation when you're swimming through this area?
Well, I think it's a good opportunity to bring the attention and to show exactly what it is, because people very often say, oh, you're going to be walking on the plastic. Well, it's not the case. It's microplastic, very small pieces that you cannot see with a satellite picture. So that's the problem. that you find. You have to be there in order to see what it is and to get any data from it.
When you are swimming like this, is it kind of, you know, I'm thinking we talk about when you drive through an area versus when you walk or bike through the area, the scale at which you get to know it, right? When you go driving by, you see, oh, there are trees and now we're gone. And when you walk through it, you see the different species of trees and the things that live under the trees. Is that the kind of knowledge and understanding that you get of the ocean when you swim through it? I mean, it is such a vast environment, but you're seeing it on such an intimate scale.
Right, and especially due to the speed, it's more walking than driving for sure. And I see things very closely. I'm there in the water with my eyes open, but we will have ways to capture all that and to monitor and to get sample from it. What I will see, just a very small portion of what we will do and how we'll communicate what we find in the ocean.
You also get a very different perspective, it would seem, from scientists who are going out there on boats and taking water samples and pulling up nets of samples, but you're actually in the water. What are your conversations with scientists like? Do you find that these different perspectives come out in those conversations?
Well, it is important to have them engage in it because I'm not a scientist. I'm just I love the environment and I have seen it change and I want to do something for my kids and for them to understand what we need to do on a daily basis to revert the process of the way we are dealing with the environment and how we are impacting the environment. So scientists are very important into the mix, into bringing real facts and telling us exactly what we need to change, where we are, first of all, and what solution we can bring. So scientists are very important and much more important than me swimming across. Me swimming across is just a way to get the attention. And then after, it's a platform for scientists, for people who know the who are experts in that field, to bring that to the attention and to get people more involved in it.
Linda, give us the big picture scientific perspective on the issue of plastic pollution in the ocean. Do we know how much plastic there actually is in the ocean at this point?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think there have been several new estimates of the sort of volumes of plastic that are entering the ocean from land. But it also is important to understand that plastic is also entering from the ocean itself as well through various types of activities. And also, of course, catastrophic events like tsunamis will bring a lot of plastic into the ocean. And I think that, you know, to some extent, the perception that there are large pieces of plastic out there perhaps come from more catastrophic events or certainly perceptions from coastlines where beaches do have larger pieces of plastic. But really out there in the open ocean, it's about these small, tiny pieces of plastic. And I think our tendency is to think that these, you know, small pieces are sort of out of sight, out of mind. But hopefully, through the research that's coming out now, as people are starting to realize that even these tiny pieces cause a threat, and they don't cause a threat sometimes to larger organisms directly, but indirectly up the food chain. And so that's one of the things that we're very interested in, is better understanding the lower spectrum, the lower size spectrum of plastic pollution in the ocean and what's out there in the gyres and how that's potentially working its way up the food chain and how it's also transporting organisms around the ocean in ways that it wouldn't, that other substrates wouldn't normally do so.
You're listening to Living Lab. Our phone number is 866-999-4626. Michael is giving us a call from Nantucket. Michael, what's on your mind?
Well, we just had a local swimmer go from Hyannis to Nantucket's Great Point, which is 26.3 miles, and it took him 12 hours, which is a little over 2 miles an hour. And if I did the arithmetic correctly, this swimmer is going to be swimming between 3 and 4 miles an hour to make the trip in 180 days. Is that attributable just to his superior training or to the smaller number of hours per day? I'm curious how he can sustain that.
All right, Michael, thanks for the question. So how fast will you be swimming and how realistic is it to think that you can do over 5,000 miles in under 6 months?
Yeah, that's a great question. So people have the tendency to jump with their calculator and to say, oh, it's so much distance to cover, that speed is there. But they don't take into consideration the currents.
So you get a boost from the currents.
Oh, tremendously. When I was swimming across the Atlantic, you know, my speed is between 2 to 2.5 knots. When I was swimming across the Atlantic, we had was swimming in the Gulf Stream with sometimes speed of 4 to 5 knots of current alone. So when you add that to my speed, it makes a big difference. Of course, it's not going to be 4 to 5 knots across. I would have probably less than that most of the time. Of course, I would have less than that, especially when I come closer to the U.S. coast. But the current is very, very strong. And that's why it's very important for me to be with the current and to have router that gives me the exact location.
How do you get the exact location of the currents and plan your track?
You have routers on land that analyze satellite maps, and that will give us the exact location, the best location to be.
Linda, let's talk about the currents and how those affect the plastic pollution he's going to see. That's why we have the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, is because currents collect it there, right?
That's correct, yeah. I think it's really important because in addition to the myth that there are these large pieces of garbage and part of the garbage patch that you can walk on, apart from that myth, which hopefully this show will help dispel in terms of what's really out there in the open gyres, is the understanding or the perception that plastic is evenly distributed all over the ocean. And it really isn't. I mean, certainly there are concentrations that are higher along the coastlines where, you know, there's direct input from rivers and other sources from land. But really, in the ocean, there is a concentration in these gyres where things are really concentrating because of the movement of the gyre itself.
And you're going to be going straight through that or along the edge of it?
Most of it, like the edge, upper north.
And Linda, what are you hoping that Ben will be able to do in terms of samples and data collection while he's out there?
Right. So the plan right now is in development, but nevertheless, we are hoping to look at actual plastic concentrations collected by either a manta or a Neuston net, which collects right along the surface of the ocean, which is where the floating plastic is found. So there's going to be quantification. There's going to be some characterization of those plastic pieces. And then we are also going to be contributing to our ongoing research looking at microbes that are living on the plastic and other types of living organisms by using DNA sequencing approaches.
So that's going to be they're bringing samples of plastic back for you to then
correct.
Analyze later?
Right. So there'll be collections. Some of it will be quantified. Other subsamples will be preserved in buffers that are compatible with looking at the DNA sequences that come from all of the DNA within the samples. And in addition to that, we also have a new component that we've added where we're going to try to look at the colonization of the plastic potentially on your snorkel to try to see how quickly microbes can actually colonize. Because, again, there's this perception that plastic doesn't get quickly colonized in the ocean. But our research is telling us that, in fact, it happens quite quickly. And so we're very interested in how that changes over the longitudinal gradient that will be sampled as part of the transect.
And what does that involve, like a daily swipe of your snorkel? Or?
That's correct, yeah. And another aspect that we've just added is actually looking at Ben's microbiome and how it's changing over the course of the actual swim. And again, how that compares to what's in the water and potentially on the snorkel itself. So that's a...
Are you expecting to see that what's living in Ben's gut could start to look more like what's living in the ocean as he spends more time in the ocean?
Well, it's a great question, and I'm pretty sure it's one that no one has ever actually asked. So
no one's ever spent 6 months in the ocean.
That's correct. I'm pretty positive of that. So that's one of the questions is, you know, we really don't know how swimming and, you know, inhaling and aspirating seawater, we don't know what effect that has on the human body. So that'll be a dimension of the work that we'll examine.
And how much does your research component cost?
That's a very difficult question to answer just because of all the labor costs associated. But we think that somewhere along the lines of $200 per sample is probably about right in terms of the molecular characterization, at least. The other types of samples are a little bit more difficult to quantify just because it depends on the volume of samples that you get. For example, as you enter the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, the concentration of plastic is going to be much higher. So your ability to necessarily characterize all those samples is going to be lessened. So we sort of have to pick and choose which kind of samples we do the full characterizations on.
I mean, unlike Ken Bissler, who has a fair bit of experience with crowdfunding in the past few years with his Fukushima research, this is fairly new territory for you. How does that feel?
Well, it's exciting and it's a little intimidating at the same time. I think, it's a great opportunity to raise public awareness. And one of the things we really want to try to do is sort of tie in the athletic component of this and changing microbiomes to see if that will perhaps really entice people to think about the science of microbiomes, but then also how we ourselves interact with the environment and what that impact has on our bodies.
And what do you expect the samples that Ben can collect on this swim across the ocean to contribute to our overall understanding of plastics? I mean, we have a fair bit of information, a fair bit of research has been directed specifically at the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. How much is that going to expand our knowledge?
Well, the transect is fairly unique in that we've really never looked across the entire Pacific and looked at such a long time series, if you will. So we're pretty excited about that. We're also really excited about the comparison, to be honest with you, with the sort of the whole picture of looking at plastics, the water column, and then also the human microbiome at the same time, and also colonization of plastic that is an opportunity, a sample of opportunity. So I think that sort of integrated question, I think, is one that's going to be pretty exciting to look at.
Ben, am I correct that this swim was originally slated to start in 2014? What happened that you're only starting this year?
Well, you know, with that type of project, it's always a matter of funding and finding the right partners for it. And that's why crowdfunding is very important. And the event itself is not being sponsored by one big company. It's people coming on together and giving, for example, the boat and the equipment on the boat or their time. And so it's much more an organic event. And
is that on purpose or is that just how it worked out?
It's how it worked out, but it allows us to keep in control of the message and to keep in control of the event and not being dictated by a bigger corporation and their message.
And when do you at this point plan to depart from Japan?
In September.
This is all kind of coming together at the last minute then, that you're just getting your science partners on board. Is that a distraction when you're in the last phases of training and preparation for this event?
No, there is never a last phase of training. You always train. It's part of the daily routine. So that's a given.
And this will also be your whole swim, right? Will be live webcast. It's going to be on social media. Was your Atlantic swim broadcast like that?
No, at the time we didn't have the technology. So here it's very important. It's to bring people into the event and to engage them into what we are sampling and to show them exactly what we are finding, to make them realize that if we start asking the question about what can we change in our daily life to lessen the impact on the environment, then that's where we want to do.
All right. So how can people follow along and find more information about the longest swim?
Just by going on the website, thelongestswim.com, and everything is linked to Ken and Linda's information as well.
All right. Ben LeCompte is a long-distance open ocean swimmer, departing from Japan in September, planning to swim across the entire Pacific Ocean. The project is The Longest Swim. You can find it at thelongestswim.com. Linda Amaral-Zettler studies plastics and the bacteria that live on and around them at the Marine Biological Laboratory. Thank you both for being here today.
Thank you very much.
Until next week, this is Living Lab. You can always find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Major support for Living Lab is provided by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment and the Candida Fund. Additional support is provided by Lee McGraw and the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. Living Lab is produced by Heather Goldstone. The executive producer is Mindy Todd.